Probably ones with sitting bags.
So okay, there? Okay, yeah, all right.
But in terms of the look, it's
lovely.
Okay.
Okay, rolling. And we are rolling again.
Now, you had another story about another incident with your Theo.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell me that story briefly? This was later on, and the strike had been going on for a while.
The grape strike went on for 5 years. So I would say that the first 2 years were sort of our honeymoon phase, you know. And then after the March of Sacramento, things began to get a little rough, you know what I mean? People began to get disillusioned and angry. And that's when little signs of violence began to appear. And tires were being ripped and that sort of thing. Rocks were being thrown. Windows were being broken. And I was a picket captain still at this time. And so my problem was, how do I keep the lid on this, you know, and keep it nonviolent? Because this is what Caesar was insisting, obviously. This was what the strategy was. And we had a couple of troublemakers, you know, the two people who were too eager on the picket line. But catching them at it was the problem, catching anybody at this. Nobody copped to it. So one day we're driving up to this picket line on this ranch, and I knew my uncle worked there, and so we pulled up, and the strikers poured out of the cars as usual, and pulling out their picket signs and their flags, and then we make our way to this crew that was right across the street working, and the foreman was standing there with his back to us, and as I walked to him, I said, that looks like my uncle, and so I'm walking toward him to talk to him. When I hear this whiz coming over my shoulder, and it's a rock. A rock is flying right past my ear. I mean, it whizzed right by my ear, and it hit him squarely in the back. And he turned around and looked at me. And I'm telling you, it looked like I'd hit him. It looked like I had thrown a rock at him. And I don't know what he saw in my face, but it was surprise. I said, and he said, "Why did you throw that rock at me?" You know, and I said, "Theo, I didn't do it." He says, "Don't lie to me." It looked like it. I could tell. I mean, I looked guilty. I looked over my shoulder and I saw this guy that was actually one of the leaders, the old leaders of the strike, and I knew that he had done it. You know, and he was just kind of smiling, and I said, "Oh man!" And my uncle just walked away from me. He just walked back into the field, and he didn't talk to me for a while after that. But, you know, we eventually made up. I explained to him, and he laughed about it later. He said, "Forget it. It's all right." You know, he understood. My uncle understood the issues of the strike. He understood about itinerant labor coming and going and how the scabs were being used. But he was in no position to support the union without losing his job. That's what it was. So I had to respect that. And the fact is that I had other relatives in the strike that were more blatant about their scabbing, you know. And I had a cousin who sent me a note, and in the first weeks of the strike, and he said, "Ando esquiroleando," which means I'm scabbing. "Come talk to me." I mean, it was an invitation to say, I'm sinning, you know, come save me. And because he always had a tongue-in-cheek attitude about his life anyway. He was an old pachuco too, you know. But I never convinced him. He just kind of moved around and laughed a lot. I had a woman cousin who was out there cutting vines at the time that Steve Allen showed up one day in his car, and again I was picket captain, so I took him around, and we're on our way in from lunch, and I see this crew out there, this crew of women out there cutting vines. Now, women did not cut vines before the strike. Okay, that's one of the things that changed. Suddenly, you see women crews out there, because they were trying to get enough workers, right? The growers were trying to get enough workers, so they put women to cut vines, which is really kind of interesting. And so I saw this crew of women. And the forelady was out there, and I recognized, it's my cousin, you know, my cousin Mary. And so I pulled over, and I went over, and I yelled at the end of the field. I said, "Mary, you know, come meet Steve Allen," right? And she was acting like she couldn't hear me, what, you know, acting funny. And by this time, all the vines are gone. You know, it's the middle of winter, and they're just cutting vines. I mean, all of the leaves are gone. So you could see them. You could see people. You couldn't hide behind any leaves. There weren't any. But she was hiding behind the little post and running and making a clown of herself. It was funny, but she never came out. In other words, mocking me, you know, indirectly mocking me. Now, but her mother, my tia, for instance, when we marched to Sacramento, came specifically to see me after the first day of the march, and she held me and wept with me. And she says, I know that what you're doing is right. You know what I mean? But her family was scabbing. Her family was breaking the law. The union law. I had another cousin who came, also of that family, who came and watched as the police were really hassling us. We're actually pushing us around. And he stood around. He had a nice car, big fancy car for the time. And I knew that he wasn't working in the fields, if you know what I mean, elsewhere. And he was very slick, very handsome young cousin of mine. And after this deputy sheriff, had particularly cussed us out, harassed us, and pushed us around, he came up to me and said, hey, don't worry, cuz, he says, I'm having an affair with his wife. He didn't put it exactly like that, but you know what I'm saying. So, I mean, little things like that really come from the fact that my family was spread out all over the San Joaquin Valley, and that we had been there since the 1920s, that I have aunts and uncles that have been four ladies and four men. And my dad was a farmer, actually, during World War II in the San Joaquin Valley. And he was commissioned to take over one of the ranches that was taken over from a Japanese-American farmer who hanged himself in his kitchen. And we were given that house. And so we lived in that house, and one of my sisters was born in that house during World War II. And so World War II was a relatively prosperous time for my family because we didn't have to travel. We didn't have to be migrants anymore. And the army was buying everything. My dad had to farm with mules because there was no gas or farm equipment available. So he farmed with mules. He farmed whatever the army asked him to farm. You know, a lot of vegetables, cantaloupes, watermelon, that kind of stuff, you know. And so he farmed by consignment and was completely supported by the army until 1945. When the war was over, the floor fell out. And other people poured into the San Joaquin Valley to reclaim the land. The corporations came in, and we were out of business by 1946 and back on the migrant path. That's part of what shaped me in the sense that I remember at 5 years old being prosperous, you know, and then six being poor all of a sudden saying, what happened? And the fact is that World War II happened. And again, 20 years later when I came back to work with Caesar and Pickett, we went and picketed the same ranch that my dad had owned for 5 years during World War II. It now belonged to a huge corporation that was related to Tenneco, which is one of the oil combines, you know, in the country. And so it seemed to me incredible that we had had this family history. And at the time in World War II, my family and my dad was one of the most successful members of the family because he had a ranch, you know what I mean? And my cousins and my dad's cousins, who were still alive at the time, used to remember that. He says, you know, your dad did well here. He was a success. Unfortunately, I mean, the war ended, and so did our fortunes.
So 20 years later, you're back, but you're back in a very different role. You've got this emerging Teatro Campesino. I mean, can you basically describe a bit about how did you get going? Did all of a sudden you appear and you had this theater and you were off and running, or what happened? How did you get the Teatro Campesino off the ground with no money, with no actors, with no place to rehearse?
Well, Caesar's warning that there was no money, no place, you know, no time to rehearse, all of that was absolutely true. There, I was actually quite drawn into the whole strike. I forgot about the theater, you know, for the first couple of weeks because I was going to the picket line and I was enjoying it. I was exhilarated by it, you know, by the struggle. I found out that I could contribute in other ways, just with songs, you know. I've been part of the civil rights movement. I learned all the songs, you know, and was able to translate them into Spanish. So, you know, We Shall Overcome became Nosotros Venceremos, you know. We Shall Not Be Moved became No Nos Moverán, you know. So it was very easy to make that transition. And with the help of Agustin Lira, who played the guitar, you know, we began to sing at strike meetings. And that was enough to begin with. But then I missed the idea that I needed to get to the next stage and start seeing if I get farm workers to perform stuff, you know. And I had these ideas of short skits, you know, which I later called actos, one act, you know, that we could do very quickly. We started improvising on the picket line. Once I became picket captain, I could get people to do anything. So I get them to start chanting, and then I could tell who was a natural clown, so I'd ask them to start clowning, you know, get up on the car and start doing this or doing that, you know. And finally I said, you know, it's time to make an announcement and to get this thing rolling. So I put together a leaflet, which is part of our museum, you know, and announced that we're going to have an organizational meeting for a Teatro Campesino. Now, obviously, it always Caesar's permission because we did this in the union office, tiny little office. And I was surprised that we had a packed house, you know. It's about 20 people. You know, that was enough to pack the office. And there was a counter, and I got up on the counter, and I began to rap to all the 20 people about the idea for a farm workers theater. And I talked for about 15, 20 minutes, and I realized pretty soon that I needed to do more than just talk, you know, because they were just staring, very, very politely staring. And so I said, do you have any questions? I wanted to ask, you know, my preguntas, are there any questions here? Lady raised her hand, and she says, yes. And I said, yeah. And she says, when does the Teatro Campesino begin? And I realized, you know, these were audience. They weren't actors. They were there to see a show. And I said, no, you're the Teatro Campesino. And they looked at me, you know, real puzzled. I said, you know what, we'll do this next week. So I thanked them for coming. I disbanded the meeting and began to plan for the next week. What I did is I made some signs, okay, with felt pens or the equivalent of felt pens. Do we have felt pens in 1965? I don't remember now. But anyway, maybe it was with chalk, you know. But the thing is that these were on simple cardboard, little cardboard squares, and I wrote Patroncito and you know, and Esquirol, and put string on them, and waited until the next week. We had a meeting in the kitchen this time of the house behind the union office. It was called the Pink House. It was a really battered old tract home, you know, that had become our dormitory. This is where I slept. This is where most of us slept, on the floor. And we used the kitchen, and so the kitchen was the largest room, so that's where we met. And again, it was a packed house, man. I announced that Teatro Campesino was going to have an organization. People showed up, and so then the object was, how do I get this thing moving? So I got the sign. I said, Esquirol, Patroncito, Huelguista. I said, who wants any of these signs? And a couple of volunteers for Huelguista. They had no problem being a Huelguista. So, okay, I hung it out at Huelguista on somebody. I said, okay, who wants to be the Esquirol? Nobody wanted to be the Esquirol. Thank God, I mean, I had Agustin Lira with me, so I hung it on him, you know, and he was able to start mocking. And so then I said, and they said, what do we do? And I said, well, what you do is you do exactly what you do on the picket line. What do you say to all the scabs? And so that was easy enough, you know. And so they began to talk and banter, and Augie began to kid back at them, to goad them. And so, you know, others wanted to do it, and they'd be, let me, you know, so they'd put on the sign, and then they give their rap. And pretty soon there's this electricity flowing in the kitchen, you know, going back and forth, and people are laughing. And I mean, it was electric. It was starting to build, and people started to walk in and crowd more into the kitchen. They were starting hanging in the windows, you know. I remember Dolores hanging her head in the window, you know, seeing what's happening, you know. And it was just fun. It was entertainment. It was something out of nothing. You know what I mean? Suddenly there'd been nothing, and now here's a show, and people are improvising. It was a discovery. What was interesting is that no one wanted to take the Patroncito sign. No one could take the Patroncito sign. They could take the contractor, contratista sign, and have real fun with it, portraying different contractors. But the Patroncito sign, no one could take, and that took a little work. Later on, we began to work that one out. But the fact is that the teatro started then on those types. We had the farm worker, we had the huelguista, we had the contratista, and we had the patroncito, right?
That's the response to that one. And La Llorona.
Somebody, el patroncito back there.
And what's interesting, too, is that we had both men and women participating. You know what, we're going to have to let them know.
David, would you let them know that nobody wanted to do the Patroncito? Why? What was going on there?
I think the reason that the campesinos had trouble doing the patroncito because that was sort of the ultimate step. It's the turnaround. And what's really interesting is that there were eventually some campesinos that could do the patron, that could do the boss, and project that kind of sense of authority, even kidding around. But they were eventually very quickly swept up by Caesar into other functions, you know, in the union. They became organizers, which is really interesting. It's an interesting reflection that in the theater you have that power to expose this. You know, it's a Rorschach test. You know, suddenly there it is. And Marcos Munoz, for instance, who couldn't even read and write, doesn't read and write, you know, just barely now, today, but he became one of the tremendous organizers of the United Farm Workers. You know, took over, who was it, Boston by himself. And but there were others, and that was very impressive to me that could happen. And those that could, and I could hold on to, became a steady part of the Teatro Campesino. They became the building blocks of the Teatro Campesino, with possible exception of Felipe Cantú, you know, who was too funny to be the boss for some reason. but he was strong in other ways, you know. But the thing is that if he had to, he could do it. The thing is that acting is a question of a psychological trip hammer that occurs in your mind. If you can portray it, then in a sense you can do it. And in real life, most of the people that become bosses have to act it to begin with. You know, they have to fake it, and then they become the boss. Then it becomes second nature to them. But the first time out, they're either overbearing or insecure. Therefore, they overcompensate. You know. And so it was just an interesting moment in the history of the theater where we exposed that particular weakness. As time went by, there were many more people that could do the boss, okay? It because that was the success of the organizing effort itself. When the workers realized that they had that capacity in themselves to take control of their own lives, their own destinies, you know. Hell, they became negotiators, you know. They became organizers. They became boycott coordinators. And this is the power, I think, of Caesar's movement, that he was able to create the conditions for this kind of transformation in people, both men and women, you know, and even children.
But also, there seems to be a transformation occurring with the teatro. I mean, the teatro was helping in that transformation and was doing other things. I think it was cold and it was tough on the picket line. It seemed to be serving multiple functions.
Those first couple of winters especially, you know, the winter of 65, 66, you know, 66, 67, were pretty crucial, you know, because there was no sign that the union was going to succeed. You know, it was desperation time. And it was just, we were just barely enough food to eat. You know, in some cases it was rice and beans and that was it, you know, peanut butter sandwiches. But how do you keep people going? Well, you keep them laughing, you know, and you keep them hoping. And you use music and you use laughter, and this is where the actos, the teatro, came in. Is that we cause people to laugh, you know, in an organized kind of way, you know, focused on ideas and focused on the dream of winning. And in the darkest moments of the strike, we were able to project the victory, you know, that would be ours. And people, you know, it was like religion. People kept the faith. They believed that what the teatro was saying, it was part of the liturgy, if you will, of our struggle, you know. And Caesar, of course, you know, was the high priest. He was the one that was taking us, the arzobispo. He was taking us through this darkness, you know, through this valley of shadows. And at the same time, I mean, there's the teatro, you know, providing, you know, the ceremony, if you will, helping to light the candles, you know, so they keep everybody moving forward. And it's a use of theater, I think, that is classic, you know, in that sense, that has been the essential function of the theater in the history of the human race. You know, that's what it's about. So in that sense, again, el teatro campesino is rooted in its basic uses. You know, there's no pretension about it. It's a real function that we were serving. And I love that about it, you know. That's why, for me, the combination of theater and politics or theater and farm workers made the whole experience of doing theater something that I could do. I never could accept or envision myself entering the theater professionally into a middle-class bourgeois world, you know, that was so different than my reality, where I'd come from. I couldn't make that kind of a leap. You know, the chasm was too big. I'm not that other person, you know. And I wish that it were easier for me to survive in New York, for instance, you know. I love being in New York, and I love doing theater in New York. But it's another reality, you know, when you're coming from the California fields and you're coming from the labor camps, that's another planet, really. I wanted to be in my own planet. I wanted to be here, and found that I could reach the world by being here. And besides that, we can't all leave. That's what Caesar was always saying. Hey, you can't all abandon the farm workers. You can't all move to the big city and look for your own personal success at the cost of this next generation of farm workers. So I decided to stick around. I decided to be here and to do this. And to do that, I needed to be able to relate to the farm worker experience. And so being with Caesar and being back in Delano and in the labor camps and in those fields was a return for me. It was a reaffirmation of who I am and who I was. And in that sense, I was able to pull my work from, I think, the deepest sources, you know. And it's a simple lesson. I mean, everybody has to speak to their own truth. Every writer, every artist has to address the humble part of themselves, you know, the part that's maybe not so flashy, but real. And that's what it was for me. So Delano became a shining star for me. It became Mecca to me. It became the place of rebirth. And again, I attributed to Caesar and Dolores and the leadership that created that, because I came into it after the strike had started. But I was very grateful that I was able to contribute in my own way, and that they allowed it, you know. They allowed it to happen and even appreciated. I think Dolores and Caesar were our biggest fans. They were always the ones that laughed the loudest. They were in the front row, you know. But I looking back now, it makes a lot of sense that, in a way, that it happened the way it did. But I know that the way life is, that these are rare accidents, you know, that occur in our lives, and so I'm thankful.
One of the things that you pointed out was when you met Caesar again in the 60s, when you saw him, you saw something of yourself in him. Can you describe it? When you saw Caesar, what did you see?
Caesar Chavez was the only leader I've ever followed, you know. I'm not really a follower. I'm sort of an iconoclast in my own way, but I must say that I fell in line behind Caesar because I believed in what he was doing. I believed in his example. I believed in his life, and I identified myself with what he had been through because it seemed to me a reflection of my life. The only difference possibly is that Caesar, because he was 13 years younger than me, did not have the opportunity. The other way around. Okay, let me try that.
When you saw Caesar again, something clicked in you. You saw there was an affinity. What was going on?
The fact is that Cesar Chavez is the only leader that I ever followed anywhere into a movement. I'm a bit of an iconoclast, but in Caesar's case, when I was 25 years old and I moved to Delano, I joined the ranks of his followers because I really believed in him. I believed in him as a leader and also really as a role model because I saw things in his life that were an exact reflection of my life. He was like me. Now, he was 13 years older than me, and he'd come from Arizona, but my parents had come from Arizona, so we had that in common. But the fact is that the only difference was that I'd had the opportunity, being younger, to have gone to college. But I saw that he had educated himself, that even though he never made it past the eighth grade, the man had the equivalent of a PhD, that he was already preparing himself for a life on a much larger stage, you know, than where he had started. And in order to do that, he had to learn quickly. He had to be very sharp. Someone put it, Fred Ross, I think, or Fred Ross's wife, she said, Caesar had a hungry mind. And it's very, very true. Caesar would devour books. And you could talk to him just about anything, any subject, politics, history, art, music. Man, he could handle it. And so I found myself wondering, where did this guy come from? You know what I mean? Where does a spirit like this incarnate and come to life? Because he was really something. I mean, he was very impressive. And And the fact is that I knew where he had come from. I'd been to those places, you know, and I knew that he had been in San Jose, had been in the barrio there. When I was living in Salsipuedes, he was in Salsipuedes. You know, in Delano, okay, his family had moved across the street from where I'd been born. Yuma, okay, I mean, the Gila River Valley. Yeah, I knew Arizona. My parents were from Arizona. So these are the same places, and yet here's Caesar, you know, talking and saying things that seem almost out of his time. And I think that's a sign of his greatness. And Dolores has these capabilities as well. And I think it's a historical imperative that the human race has to create leaders out of necessity, that someone that can articulate and then lead, because humanity needs to take a certain direction, a certain turn. And it so happens that in this case, no limitation of money or time or lack of education was going to keep Caesar from becoming who he became. And his strength came from his own character. He had a very strong character, and he was really moral, you know. He was a very moral man, and I really believe that. There was no hypocrisy in him. He was pretty honest about everything. He warned people in advance how much suffering it was going to take to do what they were going to do. There was no bullshit about him. He always told people the truth in that sense. Now, he was a leader, and he had to manipulate. He had to be political, so he wasn't a god. He was a human being, so he made mistakes. But, you know, those are human things. And the fact is that in his peak, when he was really chugging, and when he was going, and I would say that from the time of the strike, just about 1962, when he finally set out on the road that he wanted to take to form a farm workers' union, until about 1980, you know, he was at his peak, and there was nobody like him. He was confident. He was full of humor. You know, he knew where he was going. As he got older, I mean, things got more difficult. I admit it does for everybody. You know what I mean? Who can hold on to it? But the fact is that I followed him because there was no one else that I had ever met in my life that had those capabilities. And I think that history, in that sense, his impact as it dissipates into all the coming generations, you know, will register that. I think that this is what you're doing here, you know, is it registering the fact of his importance for the future.
Now, not only Caesar, but Dolores both seem to have this single-mindedness and this ability to make something out of nothing.
Right. I think it's a very important word that characterizes both Caesar and Dolores. And I think the word is gravitas. You know, they have gravity, both of them. And they're grounded. And in that sense, they're rooted to what is essential and what is important at this moment. You know, and it continues to be the same at this moment that it's been for the last 30, 40 years, because things have not changed in some respects. But they stand for the kind of social cohesion that you get out of the union, that you get out of any social movement. They stand for continued struggle, for perseverance, you know, and endurance, and persistence. And they stand for a kind of honesty that comes as a result of that. In other words, they can't be bought, that they won't be bought, not by money, not by fame, not by any kind of pretension that comes, you know, with the trappings of power. And I know that Caesar had power, and Dolores has power. She continues to have power of a personal kind, you know, the character kind. Organizationally, it comes and goes depending on this. It comes for everybody. It comes and goes for everybody in terms of the times, but there's no question that what they've set in motion came out of their own resolve, out of their own resilience, their own personality, their own being. And who knows how all these elements come together? You know how what separates a person like Caesar or Dolores from those that have come before or come after, but. They're right for the time, and they're absolutely essential. You know, when you think of Dolores, I mean, she didn't have to be a feminist. She was already completely free, you know what I mean? Out front. And it was as if she did the whole feminist movement in one fell swoop and had 11 children in the process as well. And no one can say, oh, no, she had 11 children, so she's less of a woman. No, she's more of a woman at the same time that she's completely this giant that stands up for women's rights, and And I've often described her as she was the first woman general I ever followed, you know? And that's absolutely true. I followed her into the picket lines, into the struggle, you know? And I'll never forget when we were chasing trucks, you know, in those first few weeks of the strike. And we were trying to find out where all those scab grapes were going, and we ended up one very long night sitting up outside this packing shed. It was Dolores and myself and about 6-7 others, you know, in different trucks and cars waiting. And so we ended up trailing these trucks over the grapevine to Los Angeles. Some went east into Phoenix and other areas, other markets, and some came north to San Francisco. I was happened to be with Dolores, and we went to L.A., to the L.A. produce market. And so there's a flank of us, a flange of us going into the L.A. produce market to track down these scab grapes that were being unloaded, to tell the dock workers there, don't unload these grapes. These are scab grapes from Delano, you know, we're strikers. And we're boycotting these grapes. And the moment that we did that, I mean, we were, the supervisors came running and people surrounded us, and the workers stopped working, and there was this big to-do in the middle of this L.A. produce market before dawn, okay? And Dolores is in the middle of it. And she says, you know, I'm the vice president of the United Farm Workers, and, well, the National Farm Workers Association at the time. And she says, and these are scab grapes, and we're asking you as brothers not to unload these, not to handle these. And a goon came out of nowhere and he grabbed her, picked her up, and threw her off the dock. And I saw her flying and land on her back. And again, this is just violence against the woman to begin with, but against anybody, you understand? But what she did then is she popped right back up, crawled up on the dock, and got right back into the guy's face. And I said, you know, this is courage. This is balls, you know what I mean? And I said, this is amazing, and I'm happy to be part of it. I'm happy to be here and to stand by her side. She's the same woman today. She has never given up struggling. And I think that that kind of strength, that kind of power, happens because it has to happen, because people need the leadership. And Caesar had, of course, the same kind of power. You know, they both had. It's amazing that here's a movement with a man and a woman that are equal in that regard, that have this kind of power. And that's why I'm happy to have been part of that, and I'm proud to call Dolores my friend to this day, and to call Caesar, you know, a mentor.